I hope that you have already enjoyed, I mean, the performance of your NVIDIA investment. Oh, Alexei. So, over the last...
No,
NVIDIA and Bitcoin. Yeah, absolutely.
Only
the
Bitcoin.
ETF.
There is only Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my heart beats, I mean, for ETFs. This is why, really, I'm really in for any kind of ETFs, Bitcoin or not Bitcoin. So, after passing through the VC funds and some interesting, I mean, insights that we had during the last session with two prominent VC fund managers last month, we are going to come back a little bit to what we know, I mean, more, which is trading and quant, I mean, life. So, we have, I mean, such a pleasure. I stumbled on this young man not later than 2 weeks ago, and I discovered that he has such a, first of all, I mean, he's cool. This is the most important. We never invite, I mean, the people who are not cool. So if you're not cool, you're not here. So this cool young man, and I discovered that he's really exactly his experience, which is over 20 years of trading all kind of materials. Coming is going to tell us about the exotic products that it was at the beginning of the years 2000 that you were trading all around the world and especially in London. And then after his experience, I mean, through the coming from, I mean, the trading on that those products to more, I mean, the fixed income and the interest rates, which is, I mean, considered as the toughest really products, I mean, to trade. And we want, I mean, to know about his experience, his interactions with the quants, and how really, I mean, that now we can define the job of a trader. A trader, you know, I think, I mean, 5-6 years ago, when this was really the rise of quant life, we were saying, what's, I mean, traders for? Because, I mean, it's something that quant is doing, I mean, is just done. I mean, what is, I mean, the trader can really do? And now traders are here and they are happy and it seems that they have a really nice and beautiful horizon of development. So I think, I mean, this are all the questions that we have. But first of all, I really would like that Jerome, I mean, present himself, give, I mean, a hint about where you were coming, what did you do, I mean, as studies, and how really you just fell in this this war. And then, I mean, maybe I am going to sustain, I mean, the conversation with some questions, but really I'm counting on you to, I mean, ask your questions. You know, it's here, I mean, there is no judgment, there is no, I mean, consideration, so feel free. This is, I mean, we are in a safe and cool place. Ask all of your questions that you think, I mean, judge necessary for your understanding about this thing. We have such, I mean, opportunity, so let's take advantage, abuse and abuse our guest speaker. So, Jerome, how you got here?
So maybe I'll start to give you a bit of insight of how I got into finance, because I started to work in the financial sector in the year 2000. It really was the premises, really the beginning of, you know, the big development of derivatives market. Really before that, it was mainly financial instrument left to experts, but really the asset manager community were using mainly plain vanilla product, and starting, you know, in the years 1990s and through 2000s, we started to see a lot of innovation in finance in general. So there's a massive demand from banks in general to start hiring, you know, people with scientific background to start coding and developing, you know, financial models to manage all these, you know, complex instruments. The big challenge for people at that time was there was no proper education in the world, you know. Even I remember when I studied in France through Mathsup, Mathsp, stochastic calculus was not really a subject that you would study. So usually for people who would start, you know, studying the subject of finance, first of all, the big challenge is, okay, what is stochastic calculus? You know, and it would be something very deterring, you know, stochastic integration, you know, what Brownian motion, you know, these are, it's like Chinese to me. So, you know, although you had done a lot of maths, many years of study of mathematics, yet you still had to start from scratch again. So that's the big challenge for people in 2000. So how do I got there? So as I said, I studied in MathSup. I did the engineering school in Grenoble. And I studied some very generic subject like industrial engineering, so very far from finance. But in my last year, I had an internship just to code some program for an asset management company in Paris. And it turns out that it was a hedge fund based in Paris. So I spent the summer coding some trading system for them. And then as I entered the trading room, for me, it was more like a revelation. I had never seen a guy with six screens screaming and things like that. So I started to ask questions, you know, get interested. And I knew I was a bit hooked and addicted at that time. So by the end of my internship, they told me, listen, you know, if you want to come back next year, you finish your engineering diploma. And you can start maybe next year as a junior trader in London. So right. I called my parents and I said, I'm going to an internship in London. And then I never came back. So I was from 2000 to 2021. So my dad was a bit upset because he was running a consultancy company and he thought that maybe I would take over. but that never happened. So when I started in London, my job was pretty simple. So I had coded these trading systems. It was a CTA type of trading strategies for Man Group. And I was more of an execution trader. So I was calibrating the model from time to time and executing all the orders on the market. So that was my first, you know, contact with financial market, learning of what is a bid offer, how you execute, how you're cautious with sizes, you know, just really the beginners, you know, skills. And after a few years, you know, the fund performed like an average performance. And during those years, in the trading world, you could either be on the buy side or on the sell side. What we mean by buy side is you're more of a final investors, so you take directional bet or you trade on behalf of clients. But then you had sell side trader. So sell side traders are more like market makers, and they usually sit in banks. So if you're a sell side trader, your job is to sit at your desk on a specific product, and if someone calls you, you have to make a market on your specific product. And at the time, that's where most of the growth was. So I changed, so I moved from Man Group to ABN AMRO, and I started to trade interest rate options over there. So once again, it was a bit of a fresh start, of a new start. It was very different. And then I learned about how to trade options. And for me, that also opened a massive, you know, world of discovery, you know, because it's such a big gap of complexity between trading a linear product, like a stock or a bond or whatever, and as soon as you put some convexity in it, then, you know, the mathematics involved in it and how you manage this kind of products, you know, the complexity is times 100. So it took me a bit of time, so I was working between London and Amsterdam for this Dutch bank. And I was trading many invest options with hedge funds, but also corporate clients, liability clients based on the continent. And that was really the beginning of my career. After a couple of years, I moved from ABN AMRO to Nomura. Nomura is a Japanese bank, and at the time, there's a massive size business in Asia, because in Asia, a lot of investors, especially during those years, they were sitting on massive cash reserves in dollars, and they had to invest all these dollars. So for them, you know, there were not so many alternatives. Either you buy US treasuries, or if you want a bit more pickup or yield, you know, you buy, you know, banks paper or corporate bonds. But that, you know, that was the landscape. But with the growth of the derivatives market, we started to sell to those investors and clients more complex products. So we are selling them, instead of buying a fixed rate bond, what you can do is you can buy a range accrual, for example. So a range accrual is like a fixed rate bond, but instead of receiving the mid-market fixed rate, which might be 3%, you will receive a higher rate, maybe 6%, double it, as long as some conditions are met. So the conditions could be S&P stays within a range, could be dollar yen is within a range. You can be very creative about the sort of conditions you use. So I was at the time managing this book, and we were qualifying those products as complex at the time, although for now they would look as very simple. But that was the beginning of my career in the more exotics side, you know, of the product range, I would say. So I stayed with Nomura for 2-3 years, and then in 2007, before the great financial crisis, I moved to JP Morgan, and then I started something completely new. They hired me to trade as part of macro markets, to trade long-dated FX options. So long-dated FX, it's an option on that is very long-dated with a time to expiry more than 2 or 3 years on any FX rate. And the reason they had a desk dedicated to the product is, again, because there was a very big business coming from Asia. So a lot of Japanese investors also sitting on big reserves in dollars. They were investing dollars into a product that was very complex at the time called PRDCs. I'm not sure if you heard about them, but power reverse dual currencies. So what happened at the time is dollar rates were quite high. Yen rates were very low, close to zero with the deflation. So the FX forward in dollar yen were very downward sloping. So if dollar yen spot was 100, dollar yen forward in 15 years was maybe 70. So a trade that was very attractive was for investors to sell dollar yen puts, because as the forward is very low, you can sell a dollar yen put at 70 strike and it's going to generate a ton of premium. Although from a spot basis, it looks like you're 30 big figures, you know, out of the money, but actually the forward is at the money. So you have a lot of premium coming from that. So those PRDCs were exactly as I said before, like notes, where it's like a fixed rate bond, where the investors would receive a very high coupon as long as dollar yen would stay above a certain strike. So this business was very, very, very big. So it was generating maybe $1 billion a year in revenue for across the streets for during those years. So of course, you know, all the big banks were in the streets were involved in it. And we were, you know, building massive inventories. So you can imagine 15-year trades, it stays on your book for 15 years. Yeah, so you have optionality, convexity coming from, because as a trader, your job is to generate business volume with clients. And once your trade is done, is to manage the risk, you know, coming from your book. So you make money day one, but then you know, the sales commercials are really happy, they celebrate the champagne, but then you have to manage the risk for 15 years. So at the time, yeah, the inventory every day was quoting maybe 2-3 trades. And the books were getting very big. And then the financial crisis hit. The problem is the rates in dollars started to rally. So the Federal Reserve started to cut, you know, after the subprime crisis. So dollar yen started to move a lot. And for those who you know who might be a bit familiar with how to price these things, but the dealers, because we were long those dollar yen puts, and those trades were callable as well, so the dealer had the option to call the entire trade at par. We were short rates, short dollar yen, and everything callable, so we were short correlation. So we had a very bad cross gamma risk. So that means we were short cross gamma. So every day, when dollar yen moved down, for example, I would be delivered long rates position. But the problem is during those days, you know, if Fed cuts rates, rates would go lower, and dollar yen would go lower as well. So every day you would have a very bad cross gamma PNL. So although, you know, this business generated, you know, millions and hundreds of millions of revenues during those years, then banks started to suffer massive losses just managing those risks. So I joined JP Morgan, but for a few years I was more like a fireman, you know, trying to, you know, put the fire away. So that was not particularly pleasant, because instead of, you know, doing the business stopped, of course, and for during the financial crisis for a couple of years, it was only about managing risk. And the FX market, they trade 24/7. So the point, you would go home and then dollar yen would move, someone would call you, you have some risk position, you want to hedge it or not. We had the desk in Tokyo who would start to cover. So it was a very, very stressing time. But eventually, you know, the storm kind of passed away. And then what JP Morgan asked me is to, okay, don't look at the dollar yen PRDCs anymore, just start to focus on the more healthy side of the franchise. So what they asked me to do is to start to look at cross-asset product. So once again, G10 long-dated FX options outside of yen. And the reason why a long-dated FX option is considered as an hybrid. Hybrid is when you have more than two assets in terms of in your optionality. So as soon as you have two assets, that means you have volatility exposure in both assets and the correlation between the two. So me, JP Morgan is a big boat. So you have people looking at single asset option. And me, I was looking at, you know, in the intersection. So everything that, every product that has a correlation. But when you trade long dated FX, you know, what moves an FX forward is FX, of course, but also the two rates component, domestic and foreign. So if you have, you know, domestic rate moving, then the FX forward moves as well. So that means you have three drivers, you know. So if you have an option on a very long dated FX forward, that means you have three ingredients, so three volatilities and two correlation, right? So that's why it was part of my cross asset book. And they asked me as well to look at things like equities. So in the example I gave before, we started to see demand for complex product, hybrid product, combining more than two assets. So one good example is binary option. So nowadays, if you have a hedge fund that wants to take a big bet, for example, at the end of this year on the pass of interest rates, so they may say, okay, maybe we have three cuts priced in now between now and year end from the Federal Reserves. But if they think inflation is going to be sticky and maybe we're going to have an uptick in inflation, maybe the Fed is not going to cut as much, right? So two things they could do. Either they can buy an option that pays them if rates go up. So they can buy a swaption. They can buy caps and floors. And they can also do it in a binary format. So they say, okay, the SOFR rate at the moment is 5.3. If SOFR rate goes above 6%, I want you to pay me $10 million. Yeah. So that's either zero or nothing. It's a very binary bet. So we quote those options. If a JP Morgan client calls me tomorrow, I want deck expiry, $10 million payout, 6% strike, you know, cap on SOFR, I will quote that. But the hedge funds are always very smart and a bit of a step ahead. So they say, actually, my view is that if I buy this binary $10 million payout, it's going to cost me maybe, I don't know, 30% of the payout, so $3 million premium. Now, my view is that rates are going to go up, but at the same time, equity are going to go down. Because if rates goes up, usually, you know, equity doesn't like it very much, so it's going to go down. So instead of that, I'm going to buy a dual binary where I get paid if rates go up and equity go down at the same time.
So my strike on S&P is going to be 95% of current spot and 6% on dollar rates. But now, you know, if both single options are worth 50%, 50%, you know, you do the product, it's a binary option, it's like 25% now. That's for zero correlation. But now if you have positive correlation between the two, it reduced the premium even lower to maybe 10%. So if in their mind the hedge fund is as more of a cross-asset story of equity tanking, rates going higher, inflation uptick, then they're gonna have more leverage. You know, so instead of paying the single binary option 3 million, they can pay only 1 million and make the same amount of money. So if that happens, then they come to me. So that means, okay, I want to buy a dual binary option, S&P down, rates up, show me a price. So then my job at JP Morgan is to, okay, come up with a price. So that's where I have quants, you know, working for me.
But exactly, I was going to ask exactly, what is your relationship between the quants? I mean, what they are providing you, what you are asking them, how you are working, I mean, together, I mean, to develop products.
Yeah. So, first thing, you know, we ask is it possible? You know, so can we quote that? Is there a model that could work, you know, in that scenario? And what they're going to look at in general is, do we have a model with trust in rates? Do we have a model with trust in equity? Can we combine the two? And for a product like this that is not, is like a European option, not an American option, usually they say, okay, at the moment I know the model we have is they look at the two marginal distribution in the two assets, and then they do like copula correlation, and then they have like a joint distribution, and then they can, with the numerical integration, they can come up and price every type of payoff.
Yeah.
That's quite simple. Where it becomes more tricky is sometimes if I tell them, you know, okay, what if now instead of a single rate, it's more on the rate side, the condition is not on absolute level of rate, but more on the curve. For example, 10-year rate minus 2-year rate, then that's a lot more tricky because you know, the distribution of an asset that is just a curve between 2 points in the curve is a lot more tricky. So then I give them, you know, it's like an innovation product. So I say, okay, we have this client, he wants to trade not rates versus S&P, but curve versus S&P. Then the quants will have to look into, you know, how to do the same approach and come up with a model that works, that can be approved, tested. And then it's the test of real life. Because now if I kind of divert, you know, the, I think one of the skills that are required for a guy like me, if you want to, because you can always transition from quant to trading or trading to quants, but really what's required from someone or more on the trading side is to be able to make the bridge between the risk management day-to-day and P&L versus the theoretical model. Because sometimes the model outputs are, can be a little bit more you know, abstract, but when you actually trade those products, some of the model defects, for example, could become very, very obvious. Yeah, so for example, if you miss, if the model is, usually in my space, if the model is not nicely calibrated or doesn't work very well or there's a defect, the number one problem I see is in my carry. So carry is, you know, is how your mark-to-market change with just the passage of time. So usually if you have a problem in your, because you can imagine that I don't manage, risk manage every single product in a silo, right? So I have thousands of trades that I put, you know, in my portfolio. So I'm gonna have to risk management in a consolidated way.
For each client?
Yeah.
For each client?
No, all clients combined. All clients combined, yeah. And then I consolidated all my risk across, you know, so I have first order risk, all the deltas, so I have consolidated data on rates in euro, in dollars, in Swissy. I have FX delta risk, first order risk versus all G10 pairs, and then I have second order risk. So gamma and the graal is cross gamma. So you move one asset and you deliver some position in one other asset. And usually, you know, if the model is well calibrated and your correlation are really priced close to where the market is realizing, normally between your carry and all your higher order P&L, because the basis, fundamental basis of all financial model is you hedge your delta. You hedge your delta, and what you're left with is, okay, you have a move from T to T plus one, and then you're left with all your cross move and moves in each single assets, and the P&L you're gonna make from cross gamma and gamma should be offsetted by your carry. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And if you have a defect in your model, you're gonna start to see, okay, my carry is bigger than what I make every day, so. And and then it can be very tricky to find which product is the is responsible for that. So
and the one which is not well calibrated or not well made, that model is good.
Exactly.
Exactly. So what is that? I mean, that's really interesting. It means that if we are, for example, quant, and we are happy with our models and what we are doing. If we shouldn't go, toward traders' job, if we don't want to be pissed off by everything related to P&L and especially the risk management on the long term, I'm wrong or what?
P&L is the ultimate truth, right? So there's no hiding from that. If traders have a bad P&L, it's gonna be reflected on everybody, right? And then I say, okay. It's not behaving well, this model, and then of course, quants will be called in rooms, and we're going to have find some solutions. Even, for example, you clearly identify the problem. So, for example, for me, I remember one problem I had was we were using a local vol model at some point, but local vol model is really good to calibrate to the full smile, as you can see, but it's very bad when you start to price forward vol. Mm-hmm. So for example, so that's the argument between local vol model and stochastic vol model is the forward vol behavior. So if you start trading product with forward vol exposure and you have a local vol model, you could end up, with after big move in the market with discrepancies between your mark to market and where it's priced in the market. Another, I think one thing important I would advise you guys is, I'm sure it's the case, but you need to be very proficient with technology as well, because sometimes the models are very good, but some products I trade, for example, are not necessarily at expiry payoff with quick numerical integration, but they can be models that I need to price in a tree or with Monte Carlo, especially the one with American optionality. So if you trade like a 30-year fixed bond range accrual, as I said, that is callable, then you will price with Monte Carlo. And in that case, it's going to eat a lot of performance from technology to run your risk every night. So me, I had problems sometimes, or onboarding too many trades at the same time, and then we didn't have all the compute power to generate my risk in the morning. So I'd come in the morning, and then my middle office would tell me, Jerome, we don't have risk this morning. So it'd be a bit of a disaster.
And because all of the your products that you're trading, they are in the OTC market.
All are OTC products, okay. Exactly. Some are very complex. So for example, the most complex product I did once was with some Korean pension fund. They traded with me like a triple range accrual, like a 30-year fixed note where they would receive a very high coupon as long as euro dollar would be in the range, S&P would be above a barrier, and the curve in dollar rate would be above a certain level. And the whole thing was credit linked. to the Republic of Korea.
Yeah, the credit
Republic of Korea. So if Republic of Korea defaults, then you know they would redeem the note at zero, and the whole thing was callable. So the, I had many factors in that. It's really multi-asset. So as soon as you start multiplying the factors, you know the compute time to run the risk and everything was very big. So during COVID, I had a big inventory, and then the market were moving, and sometimes I didn't have my risk. So then we started to have GPU, you know, implementation, CPU, all these things to try to accelerate, you know, all the risk computes.
So this really, if I understand the interaction that you have, this is specific to JP Morgan, is that, so as a trader, as a buy side trader.
Me, I'm sell side trader.
You sell, no, so, I mean, because I mean the explanation at the beginning that you get, I said, okay, is.
Buy side traders are more like final investors,
finals.
Which they just take, you know, risk in the directional views in the market. Either on behalf of clients or your hedge fund, for example, and sell side traders, they sit more in banks. So you sell kind of complex product to customers and you manage the risk out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So you could be a market maker in FX option, for example. You are on the sell side.
Yeah, because a little bit they really, really overlapped a little bit. But so it means, I mean, your typical day. I'm your client, I'm a hedge fund, and I'm calling you. And I say, look, I mean, in-house, we discovered that there is some opportunities in, for example, this inflation and maintaining, or for example, the rates, I mean, we're going to. So the person that you are calling is directly you. So you're a kind of, I mean, a little bit a kind of sales also,
yeah.
Order?
So we have on the front office, we have traders and sales.
Mm-hmm.
And sales are responsible for managing the client request. So usually the client, they don't speak to me directly. But for those who would contemplate moving on the trading side, now the requirements from banks has changed a little bit in terms of what they're looking for traders. They ask you to also have some commercial skills. Why is
it? Want them to liquidate
the
sales army of salespeople?
Yes.
It's not so
promising. Yes,
don't go towards sales.
Exactly. No, because you're supposed to also promote your franchise, and they ask you to go out there and meet clients as well. So clients, they love to meet traders to exchange market views. What's your best trade idea? What you advise me to go long, to go short, in what market?
How far you can go? I mean, to provide them advices in.
No, you can go quite far. No, you can go, and they're obviously obsessed with knowing all the flows. So what all other guys have been doing? You know, what have you seen? You know what? So you can. There are some generic terms you can use. You never say any specific trade, any specific name, but. You know, we have two names to when we speak about clients. We have either the hedge fund, we call them fast money, and we have the
pension
more traditional pension funds, insurance companies, asset managers, more traditional, and we call them real money investors.
Real.
Why real money? As opposed to leverage money.
Oh, yeah.
On the hedge fund side. So we are real money investors and fast money, and they love to know. You know, what real money guys have done, what fast money guys have been doing. Because what moves the price eventually is the flow, right? So, all the time.
So what does that mean, your typical day? For example, today, started after your coffee, what did you do? I mean,
first thing we do in the morning is, so I have a team of three people working for me in London. And first thing we do in the morning is we open our risk. So we look at what our risk look like in, you know, across FX, rates, because nowadays I trade FX, rates, equities, precious metals. I'm trying to onboard oil, energy as well. So we look at all our first, the biggest risk is of course first order delta. So what do we have in FX, in rates and equities? Then we look at our higher order risk. What do we have in gamma, for example? So if I'm long gamma in euro, for this morning I came to the office, I was long 30 million gamma in euro. So I thought, what do I do about it? You know, if I keep it and the market moves, I can make some money in convexity, but then I know at the end of the day I'm going to have some theta, some carry bill to pay. So do we keep it or not? So we decided that actually today was going to be a bit quiet, so we decided to hedge it. So how do you hedge gamma? You just sell an FX option. So I just went in the market and saw some 3 months at the money, you know, to cover my gamma.
Approves? I mean, the last person who approves. I mean, the deal or
so. So the very, I would say, one of the things I like the most about financial market is there's no much hierarchy. Mm-hmm. So if you work in a team on a book, it's usually at least two, three traders minimum, and you really work as a team. So. Every decision is kind of collegial, you know, we try to share, you know, we can have arguments, we can have disagreement, you know, if you want to go be long and I want to be short, then maybe we're going to be neutral. I'm the boss, so I better make money.
The one thing I learned
is don't never go against your boss, because if you're right, he's going to be pissed off because he had the wrong idea to start with, and you know. If you lose, then it's double whammy, so never go against your boss. So it's quite collegial in that way. And then after we discussed about positions in the morning, then we look at, you know, if we have any pipeline during the day. So, for example, I had a call with New York sales because they're trying to pitch some new ideas to a client. Specifically, the trade I was mentioning before, that there's a client in the US who is worried about inflation, so he wants some protection against his core long equity portfolio. So he wants to buy protection in equity, and the cheap one would be this dual binary. So we're quoting from him some dual binary, some contingent option as well, some equity puts contingent on rates of being higher. And after that, you know, you have requests. It's a bit like McDonald's. You know, you can have requests that can, you know, you have to, you sit on the desk, it will be nothing for an hour, and then all of a sudden you have two customers coming, and then you have chop, 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 you know, to flip those burgers and show the prices and move quickly. That's what can be, and you need to be able to take it, because sometimes, yes, it can be a bit pressure environment to, if you have to make a price in a very large size in a very short period of time. So one thing where we look for when we recruit traders, okay, we don't necessarily want the smartest people. We want people who can make the right decision even under pressure. Because I've seen very, very smart people who kind of don't take pressure very well. Even when it's pressure coming from a large trade from the clients, or when the market starts to move and you lose money. Because then, you know, it's about keeping your head clear all the time. And because I think I calculated before, I think I survived maybe 7 big crises. So I had the dot-com crisis, and then the great financial crisis. Then there was the sovereign crisis in Europe,
the Greek
crisis. For me, the most horrible one was the Swiss DPEG, the Swiss franc. Mm. Yeah, you've not heard, you know, the SNB had pegged the Swiss franc against the euro. Oh, yeah. And I was managing the Euro Swiss book, option book. And when they announced it in 2015, the currency moved 30%.
Yeah, 30%.
So, me, I had reports in my option book, only plus 5%, minus 5%. I didn't have anything beyond that because it was never seen before. The problem is when the currency moves, you have many short strikes. They said I think the spot was 120. If you have a short strike at parity, it was worth zero the day before in your book because it's just so far from the money that this option is worth zero. But if you cross it and it's in 100 million, you are now 100 million long. So you don't know what you have. So it's like you cross many, many strikes and you throw a dice and you just don't know what your delta is. So I remember I was, even the spot traders who don't have any options, so they don't have this problem, platform they were using was breaking all the time, so they were taking order like the butcher, like you know, with a pen and paper. And there was a queue of salespeople just asking for market, and the markets were this big, and everyone was trading. Everyone wanted to get out of this position, and I remember I was calling my middle office midday, said, listen, you need to run a very urgent P&L report and delta report, because I can't run it, I don't have the tools. And one guy came back and said, you're down 50 million. So I was kind of packing already my mug, and guys, I'm done, you know, it's a good ride, you know. And then they called me back, oh, we forgot to revalue your cash position, so you're only down 10. So after a few days, I managed to make it back. So eventually, and that year I finished, I think, one of my best years. So,
because it was volatile.
Then that's why you test it, because you need to keep your head up and keep fucking trading as if nothing happened, you know, and so you have bad days, you have good days coming, so then there's the Swiss franc, then Brexit was horrible. Brexit was absolutely horrible.
You're talking about the day? I mean, that's
the day of Brexit. No one saw it coming.
I
was in London, I had very big position where I was short dual binaries with equity lower and dollar FX above. And we all went home that day thinking, okay, there's 90% chance it's going to be remain, right? So still, you know, something in my head is like, what's going on? And then we hired this guy, a political expert. He was sitting on JP Morgan floor with 200 traders. He was sitting on a chair with a microphone and commenting the results, you know, as you would do. And as the night would kind of carry on, at some point, around 2 a.m., I got a call saying, you need to come back, because there's some traders saying that now it's kind of 50-50. So I went back, and then I saw my boss and everyone running, but the markets were not open. Only some FX market in Asia were open. And then I remember my boss coming saying, it's Brexit. It's Brexit. So the market's going to open like fuck nowhere. And I had big risk. I didn't know what to trade. I could only trade S&P futures in Asia. So that was very, very stressing. And then I think I traded from 2 a.m. until midnight the next day. So, so I went back completely exhausted. And I remember my father-in-law said, Jerome, I know what you need. I said, okay. Pasta bolognese and a glass of red. I still remember this day. So
the Brexit. I mean, that's really interesting. The days of the great financial crisis. I mean, September 2008. What you were doing? I mean,
so I was training the PRDC book that time. Yeah, the yen PRDC. They're very, very terrible. With Brexit, it was one day and then maybe one week. With the Swiss DPEG was same, you know, one day and one week. But the problem with the Great Financial Crisis was an extended period.
Yeah.
Never-ending period.
Yeah. So that dragged a lot of people down. Not only you would be struggling with markets and your clients, but also the same company you work in, the stock is going down, and then some would go under. People were paid in shares, and then all their wealth would go down. Their Bierstein is being bought back, and that is just an absolute mess.
How do you reacted? What was your first thoughts when you read about Kerviel's
Kerviel, yeah. First of all, I was a bit amazed that was possible. I didn't realize how is it possible to maintain, to maintain this kind. So there's a couple of course, there's some big flaws in their, you know, control system, of course. And big, I would say probably not because of Kerviel, but thanks to Kerviel, now I have to take at least 2 consecutive weeks completely off work without interaction, zero.
Thank you, Jean.
Because now, because of Kerviel, there's this rule.
That's the French solution.
Yeah, exactly. All traders have to take leave and not interact. Because that's what Kerviel was doing. He was going on holiday, but he was still in the middle office. Can you roll this fictitious trade? He was, you know, flattening position that didn't exist. And then obviously it's the, when they unwind his position, that was done in a very bad way as well. So instead of 1 yard loss, it was 2 billion or so, whatever it was. But
so what is you know, the result? I mean, is that when you have, I mean, a losing position, you need, I mean, to liquidate it as soon as possible.
Exactly.
Okay.
So I think the number one also, you know, I was thinking about the kind of skills we look for into people is also very high integrity. So if you spot a mistake or a mistake you may have done, don't hide it. It's very important that you raise your hand quickly and you accept it and move on.
We work on that.
The worst kind of people I've seen in my career are people who argue all the time and try to, you know, be defensive, and then, you know, they never cut their losses. That's very, very bad attitude. So first thing is admit your mistake. Even when you trade, that's what I ask also my juniors, is if you put on a position, have a clear stops, you know, and be quick to cut your losses, and, you know, and to accept your mistake and move on, you know, as opposed to trying to argue all the time, say it was not your fault. But the worst is, yes, you know, if you find a mistake, very, very quickly. For me, the biggest fear sometimes when you have an option book is to miss an expiry. So if you have an option that is in the money, you forgot to call the client to say I exercise.
There is not systematic alarms on that?
So there were, but sometimes some optionality we had, not necessarily on Vanilla FX option, but for example on callable JP Morgan notes, when you have a call decision. It was not, I mean, we had a flagging system, we knew it was coming, but you know, when you have 2 or 3 a day, one day, you know, it's like bank holiday here, a trader is missing, and then someone from middle office didn't pick it up, and then shit, we missed a call decision. It happened to me, you know, 2-3 times. And then you have to call the client and say, sorry, we called it. And then it's up to him to say, I accept or not. But then it could be a $20 million decision, you know, if it's very bad. So,
what are the criteria, for example, if you want to enlarge, I mean, your team, what is, I mean, the criteria, I mean, that you recruit? I suppose, I mean, it's HR and all this, really, all this machine to recruit at the JP Morgan. But who says, I mean, the last word? What's, I mean, the people that you're meeting?
So, we have, there's the first filter. It's called, we have like a recruitment center where, first of all, it's going to be all dealt by HR. So you put an application through a website, and then based on basic criteria that they have, they're gonna select a bunch of people, maybe 20% of all applicants. And if you're invited, to London or New York, and then you're gonna go through an assessment center there. Mm-hmm. So then you're gonna be sitting and put through some scenario analysis, being a market, corporate finance, depending on what you're enrolled for. And then later on during the day, you're gonna have interaction, or you're gonna debrief the case you worked on with people from the floor. So me, every year I participate. So I go to London and I interview people. And then at the end of the day, if you want to join this particular desk, then it's up to us. You know, we may have 20 CVs and to make a selection. And then usually you start with an internship. So we have a summer internship program every year. We have also an internship that starts in September, so we have many options. The one thing I would advise is you go on the website, or you can ask me, but there are some very clear dates you don't want to miss. You know, you have to put your application before a certain date, because every year I have calls for, hey, you know, I'm a cousin of your friend, of I want him to start in trading, can you take him, you know, and we say, yes, but there's nothing I can do if you didn't put your application on time, or there's zero.
The deadlines for each.
Yeah. Where I have more impact is after you pass the first filter, and then you go through the assessment center. If I meet you, then yes, I can have a say.
But assessment, meeting, I mean, the day you interview them, but in, after you interview them for the second time, I mean, when they want to join, I mean, you're...
Yeah, and then if you've been selected for this first filter assessment center, you may be called for interviews again, and then you meet everyone on the floor, on the desk. You may have, Now, I think now it's not as bad as it used to be. I remember for ABN AMRO, I did like 15 interviews.
It's
very bad, yeah.
But is what you are assessing people on? I'm not going to ask, I mean, the exact questions that you're asking. But at that level, what is, I mean, the questions that, what is the criteria that you're looking for that that person really checks?
First of all, I think you need to sense that the person is really passionate about it, because although, you know, working on the trading floor, it looks glamorous, you know, and the best seat you can have it within the banks, but there are lots of days where actually it's not that glamorous, you know. You may have a problem with a model and you're going to sit in the machine room trying to work with quants on what's the problem, and it's not as glamorous, right? So you need to be passionate to work through those problems and come back, you know, and push the agenda off the desk. So, and also I look at, you know, how you your quantitative skills are very important. So yeah, if you have to be good in math and good with numbers, of course. And so also the teamwork, you know, if you show ability that you're a very strong team player, that of course is some, you know, big positive.
What is the background of your team members?
I have one Ukrainian guy is a doctor in mathematics. I got one girl from Lithuania. She went to Singal and then she did like an MBA in Norway, I think. Then we have loads of guys from Imperial College, Cambridge. You have big communities of Moroccans who went to Polytechnique, and Central. Probably the only one that didn't go to Polytechnique and Central. But the problem now, I think, is there's so much demand that in my days, you could come from more diverse background in terms of studies. I mean, I didn't do the best school in France, but I managed to. If I had to go through the system again, I wouldn't go through today. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
So it is. I mean, it is really the criteria of the algos that are choosing.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think it's not. I mean, I understand they have so many applications that they need somehow to, you know, filter people. But I think this joke that goes around that if you go on the website and you go in your French, and you want to apply on the trading floor, and you go to the drop-down menu of the school you did, they're only free. You can guess the ones. But that's, I guess, if you start at internal level, if you already have some experience somewhere else, it's always possible to interview.
But is it true in London also? Or?
It's mainly from London. Yeah, at least the global markets department is the two main hubs are London and New York. Only because of Brexit recently, now, like I did, more traders are now sitting in Paris. And this is changing. Now, more and more people are coming to Paris. This is quite good news.
No, anyway, that's open. I mean, the time flies. I mean, frankly, I mean, I didn't notice that we have been, I mean, talking for an hour. So, floor is yours. I mean, if you have any questions, please feel free, I mean, to ask.
Yeah, one question regarding the so the quant of all the that framework that you explained, when you have a new product and everything, you go talk to the quant, they try to adapt those models. In general, how long is that process? Because when you are asked for a price, I'm assuming this should be very short time. Mm. But when it's a new product, how long does the client tolerate you for like to set up all that infrastructure before giving him an answer?
So if it's to fix a model and for some calibration issue, it can be as short as 1 hour. Now, if it's to say, for example, I'll give you an example. At some point, I had clients who wanted to take position to go long volatility, but they don't want to manage delta, they don't want to have strikes. So I said, how can I be long vol without any strike? So I said, yeah, there's a product for that. It's called a volatility swap. So so either you can do a vol swap, you look at realized volatility over a certain period of time, and you have a volatility strike, and you pay out the difference. Or you can have a vol swap where every year a client is going to have the move between, you know, if it's a yearly coupon, between the beginning and the end of the coupon, you look at the FX move, and then you pay this amount. You know, so it's a strike-less volatility position. So I told the quant, you know, we need to come up with a model that we trust that can price this, right? So, and it took them 1 year. It's not so much the coding and the model.
It's compared to what you do, but
nowadays you also, once the quants have come up with a model, it's tested, of course, but then you have controllers on the side that will test it. It's called model risk group. And those guys, you don't want to have to deal with them. So they're like the, you know, the police, the quants. It depends on the complexity, you know. If it's a rather simple model approach, it can be quite quick. If it's something as difficult as a volatility swap, you've never done it, then it can be a bit more complex. Yeah.
So how do you deal with the client when you tell him, okay, we have
see you in 1 year.
So yeah, exactly. So usually maybe the client has done it with another bank, so therefore you try to accelerate the process. But sometimes some of these clients, they have long-term view. So if they are pension fund, their investment horizon is 30 year plus. So I mean, if you're not ready now, you're ready in 6 months. Okay, maybe they're going to trade the first clip with another bank. Come back in 6 months, they may have more to do. So
I will just go for some vanilla until
either that or maybe another bank is able to do this product. So they're going to trade with someone else, and 6 months later, when you're ready, they maybe going to trade with you. There's always also this competition aspect, you know. So it is,
Okay, thank you. So you mentioned that salespersons are working with you as well.
Yep.
And that they're trying to pitch things to clients. How does that work? Is that clients coming to the sales team asking for something specific, or the other way around? Like, you guys come up to something new and you put something together.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
So it works both ways. So sometimes we receive what we call RFQs, requests for quotes.
Mm.
So that means you don't have to generate anything. You just pick up the phone.
Okay.
Hello, you know, I'm BVV, a German pension fund. I want a 30-year range on euro and dollar rates. That maturity in that size, what's your price?
Okay.
So then it's pretty easy. And sometimes the client doesn't have an idea. So what we sales do sometimes, they sit with us, they sit with research. Research guys are also important in the ecosystem. Sometimes they will identify, for example, you know, maybe dividends are priced too rich in Europe versus, so is there like a relative value trade to do there? So maybe we could sell you a product where you benefit if the dividend spread between Europe and US mean revert back to a certain level, and there's a good story behind it. Then sales will sit with research, hey, that's quite good, can we put a price on it? And then when it's ready, we just saw it through to the clients.
That's interesting. So that's, I mean, when the researcher event team is coming.
Yes, so we have research, we have strategist as well. We have, and even within the research group, we have economists who are really, you know, absorbing all the data day to day, making predictions and analyzing all the reports. And we have quantitative research. So they will look at, out of all the G10 pairs, what's the cheapest volatility, what's the highest volatility, where is the skew more attractive, in what pair have we deviated the most from historical levels. So they produce a lot of material. Even me, I use it for me, because as much as I said, you know, my job is to do some franchise business, but I also take risk. So if I want to take risk in euro tomorrow, I can, you know. So
you should be aware of
my P&L is usually split 70% franchise and 30% is called prop trading. So
you do, I mean, proper, you know, the capital of the bank.
Not all the time, but if we have views,
because the propositions coming from the research team that this is going to be something.
Either its result is something a bit more elaborated, like an arbitrage between something a bit more complex, or it can be just as simple as there's a central bank meeting tomorrow, and I don't think they're going to cut, I don't think they're going to hike. I can take a position in a futures contract, so that's very simple.
Right, that's
Any other questions?
In your job, how often do you use data science or machine learning? Not only you, but even people around you or quants? Or
So we use it more and more. And I wouldn't say what is more disruptive is not so much, I'd say, machine learning to start with. Is more like e-commerce and algos replacing traders slowly. So, for example, we have algos who can make market to clients now. Mm-hmm. So a client wants to trade in particular, you know, vanilla liquid instruments. Instead of calling, you know, voice a salesperson on the sales desk, he will just open, you know, a website with the platform delivered by JP Morgan and trade with a click. So you can do that as a platform, and sometimes even now it's more elaborated. Client, instead of just saying I buy, I sell, he's going to say, okay, I have 100 million of euro Swiss to buy tomorrow in the market, but I don't want to, when I put the order, I don't want to move the market against me. So instead of that, I will use an algo strategy where I'm going to, it's called, for example, TWAP, time weighted average. So it's going to try to spread over a certain given time, try to capture liquidity as it comes, try to go through the order without much disruption. So, and it can do via an algo. So we have.
So you're providing also, I mean, the execution services.
Yes.
I mean, market impact, the
reduction,
the slippage.
You can go manuals on the platform, but you can also use an algo that will implement a strategy for you in terms of, you know, filling
so
the
you
order.
Are somehow
it's not me, it's like a dedicated.
But you are somehow a prime broker of your clients also.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
And we have quants that work on this side, so it's more about high frequency trading, and I don't understand very well when they speak. They use terms like geodesic. It's quite hard mass the way they do it, and they weave heavily, technology involved. Yeah.
I had a question. It was more like macro related, but I was wondering about the liquidity of the markets that are targeted.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned equity, and I'm seeing the markets kind of evolving since the last years. And how does that impact the products that you propose to the clients? And maybe you can say, okay, one day. The status of the market is not relevant anymore, and we avoid this. So I don't know.
Yeah. So, So when we price a product, there's the mid market price, and then there's how much I charge. So if there's a if we go through times, for example, we have a lot of stress, it's a risk of environment, and if I need to cover some Vega, some Gamma on the back of it, and the bid offer in the FX option market have widened a lot, then I will double the charge. I will just reflect that. So that's my job, to make sure, you know, I calibrate my charges based on the liquidity of the market. But back to your point, it's true that for the last few years, we see a deterioration in liquidity. Can be very liquid at times and zero liquidity at other times. It used to be more even average, a bit better than others sometimes, but more like good all the time. But nowadays, it's becoming problematic.
The OTC market.
OTC, even the liquid market, even the treasuries, the repo market, sometimes you can see gaps, even sometimes in the FX, you know, and underlying FX options, the liquidity is very uneven nowadays.
Yeah.
So I know JP Morgan, they run a survey across for all traders, and that's one of the biggest concern is liquidity conditions.
But don't you have a market making team in GP that you can deal with if there is not enough liquidity?
Well,
I mean, do you always deal on the market, or can you also deal with them?
It depends in what instruments, but me, when it fits the spot market, FX spot market, that's the most liquid, you know, market in the world, I don't deal with traders or market makers. I have what I described before, just a platform where I can trade, you know, on a platform. So it's an algo behind it. Now, if I want to trade a vanilla instrument as, for example, a rate swaption, then I can't really deal with that. On the liquidity is not good enough to trade on the platform. So then I will speak to the swaption trader.
I'm going to. You're getting really to the end of the time. Just I'm going to ask. I mean, the last question. This is something only you can answer. That you have gone. I mean, through many distinguished entities that many of us are really doing. I mean, to work in. Among all these banks, I'm not going to Mango Group and you know. What is the difference which distinguished the culture of JP Morgan to the rest of these entities? You know, I was really surprised. I was talking to the head of the fixed income markets at Morgan Stanley, and once, I mean, in the discussion we got, I mean, further, and he said, I said, what would be, I mean, your dream of job? What would be? He said that just having a position at JP Morgan. So you are working at Morgan Stanley. Come on, this is, I mean, something really amazing. So now their culture of their working and banking culture, it is really beyond, I mean, the rest of the world. I was wondering, I mean, if it's true, or what you felt when passed, I mean, through the Nomura to JP Morgan.
When I transitioned at the time, JP Morgan was already a big name, but that was not the biggest name. It was, I think, Goldman Sachs at the time was really where you thought people would make more money, and you know, the best traders and the smartest guy would be at Goldman Sachs. Then there was JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, and then of course we had the Lehman Brothers and the guys who disappeared later on, but Bank of America. I think for me, so I could feel straight away that yes, there was a very emulative environment, and JP Morgan was good at attracting talent, very diverse talent from various countries. But I think for me, the biggest difference was between European banks and American banks. I'm not so sure, back to your friend's story, that working at Morgan Stanley or at JP Morgan or BofA, maybe BofA is a little bit behind, but Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley or JP, I think, it's probably the same. You probably have a bit more gravitas at JP Morgan because we have a bigger commercial bank, and now we're seeing a bit more, you know, the dominant player out there. But then where there's a massive gap is when you go to European banks. And unfortunately to me is, well, not to me, but because I'm a bit chauvin, you know, but the gap didn't used to be that big between European banks, and because we had BNP Paribas, we had Paribas, we had SocGen, which was in equity derivatives in 2000, was the best bank to be in. And now there are just little, you know, attrition of what it should have been. After the financial crisis, it started, the dominance of US banks only started to grow bigger and bigger. We thought at some point maybe they're going to catch up. But I think that there's some big mistakes in terms of how the banks were saved through the financial crisis, and the European banks were left dormant and a bit zombie for too long. In the US, they were much, much quicker to get them on their feet and to capture on opportunities again.
It's because of Jérôme Carvier.
Yes, maybe.
Because of the euro. Since to help the bank, you needed to print money, that you need to have the agreement of every nation, whereas in the US, well.
Yeah, I think. Not so much, I would say, in derivatives market, but there were some mistakes done by some of the European banks, and there's some cultural thing as well. You know, they may be a little bit slower to react and to adapt to innovation, and then
over intellectualizing the things.
Probably as well. And also in terms of promoting people internally, you know, in the US banks is a lot about merit, and we don't, for example, it's a very good example, is if you're in a US bank, we're gonna ask you once what school you've done when you were hired. After that, it's finished. It's more like, oh, what desk have you been on, you know, have you been doing these years, what have you, what's been your P&L last year? If you went in SocGen and said, oh, what school did you do? You know, even
10 years later.
20 years later. I want to know which school you did. So this cultural thing as well, there's probably, you know, more, you know,
it's
political game in some of the European banks on the cultural side. So maybe they didn't choose their battles always nicely. But what's true is that they were really, you know, on the level playing field with the US banks in the 2000 years, and somehow they lost for, you know, and for the long term period, the steam, exactly. And all the best guys, finally, all the French guys moved to US banks. Yeah.
Okay, really, thank you so much, Jérôme. Really so candid manner, and this is really what you're looking, maybe the